afternoon, everyone. Happy Wednesday. I am Hank Jones, and you are listening to Hank Jones Poly Sports on Global Patriot Radio here at blogtalkradio.com. That, of course, is the Iowa Hawkeye fight song. You know how people say, like, I think it was in Bull Durham, I hate it when people get the words wrong. I hate it when people say, we're going to fight for Iowa. It is not we're going to fight. So if you ever do that and suddenly out of nowhere a fist comes and smacks you, it's probably just me. Because I hate that when people do it. It's not where it's the word is fight for Iowa. But that be that as it may, as I said, I am Hank Jones, and you are listening to Hank Jones Poly Sports. Got other shows on Global Patriot Radio every Monday, the Vito Esposito Show featuring Vito and Big Al, Mamma Mia No Sharia. Tuesdays, The Cross and the Crescent, otherwise known as Radio Free Kafiristan. That's Eric from Kafiristan. And then Wednesdays, of course, me, Hank Jones, with Hank Jones Poly Sports, where we talk politics and sports, sometimes both, sometimes at the same time. Thursdays, the deplorable Paul Sutliff, and I mean deplorable in a good way, brings you the Sutliffian Report. And then Fridays, Andrew Herod is in with Conservative Casual Friday, sometimes known as Islam in Focus. Saturday nights, 10 o'clock, Minister Usama Dakduk and the beautiful Christie, revealing the truth about Islam. And that's especially good at 10 o'clock Eastern time, is especially good for people that don't want to have to watch Pac-12 football. Like me. Hank and little Aussie are here at home. Mrs. Hank is still house and pet sitting in Washington State, where we were last week and weekend for the daughter's wedding on Friday. Great time. We'll talk a little bit about that. And I want to thank Vito for handling the show last week, and brother Tommy as well for calling in. Good stuff. I even got to call in for a little bit. I'm going to recap quickly. So Tuesday night, at 11:50 or 11:55, Mrs. Hank gets the text from Southwest Airlines that our 6:20 a.m. flight is canceled. Yeah, gave her a link to go. And so we got in there. We got our 9:20 flight, and which was a few minutes late. Then we got to Denver, and we were supposed to have like an hour, and it turned into like 3.5-4 hours. They wouldn't – Mrs. Hank kept doing the things you're supposed to do, and she's in the travel industry in a way. You know, things you're supposed to do, like explain why we needed to get, you know, better priority seating so we could make sure that our baggage did not have to be checked, et cetera. We got there late. I still got to the tux place. My tux fit immaculately. In fact, I did so well on the pre-wedding weight loss, they had to give me a smaller shirt. Seriously, they had to give me a size smaller shirt. Yes, Hank did it for the wedding. Got down to my wedding weight, the same as I weighed on my wedding day. Pretty impressive, I thought. So they did that, got it, got all squared away. And then the wedding was on Friday. Well, my son-in-law is a Montana graduate, as were five of his seven groomsmen. And we'll talk about it later. So anyway, but yeah, what could have been the flight and the trip from hell got better progressively as things went on. So yes, it was enjoyable. Let's get to our recent obituaries. Last Wednesday, we lost women's wrestler Shannon Spruill, a.k.a. Daphne, to suicide at age 46. She wrestled in WCW, Shine, and then later TNA. She became the second woman to hold the WCW Cruiserweight title before they eventually sold that company to WWE. That was when WCW was like making up anything, any kind of gimmick. So they had two different women hold the Cruiserweight title. She later wrestled the independent circuit before she resurfaced in TNA. She'd suffered some injuries and eventually stopped in-ring wrestling around 2011. So last Wednesday morning, she posted a disturbing Instagram video. She read a suicide note. She showed what appeared to be a gun, and she included her wish that her brain be donated for CTE studies. That's chronic traumatic encephalopathy, brain injuries from, you know, contact sports. Law enforcement ended up going to several addresses before her family pointed them to the current one, where she was indeed found of a gunshot wound to the chest. Numerous current and former wrestlers have taken to social media, urging more wrestling organizations to focus on health and wellness for the wrestlers. Now, it continues to be pointed out, pro wrestlers are dying too young and too frequently, no doubt about it, and without more attention, the industry will face more and more scrutiny. The following day, the wrestling world lost Steve Gower, a.k.a. Steve the Brawler Lawler. He passed from COVID at age 56. He's no relation to Jerry the King Lawler. Now, he wrestled mostly in Southern independent promotions that were affiliated with the NWA, the old NWA. He mainly wrestled tag team matches. He also filled in for numerous masked wrestlers. I guess that was a thing, filling in for masked wrestlers. He actually won a championship belt for Joe Pettisino's old Georgia All-Star Wrestling. He was also quite outspoken, calling out the sleazy promoters that were shorting wrestlers on money and not doing, you know, quality productions. He called out a lot of the gimmickry, the modern wrestling gimmickry, such as TNA's octagon-shaped ring, the fact they started calling it sports entertainment instead of wrestling. He really hated the breaking of kayfabe. That's where wrestlers who are feuding will maybe break kayfabe by hanging out together publicly or reveal various backstage and insider secrets to the media or the public at large. As an example, a Ric Flair would never hang out in public with Sting, especially like at bars and restaurants. Flair himself, I remember in his book, lamented the fact that pre-show practices and staging was actually being allowed to be seen by venue personnel and their kids. Like a security guard would go in and take his kids to watch them practicing. And Flair said that was terrible. Ted DiBiase, as the Million Dollar Man, he would often go to local bars after matches and buy a round for the bar. And when he stepped away from that character, he stopped doing that. And he was actually surprised that some local fans actually complained about it and said, "You need to be the Million Dollar Man and buy us all drinks." Well, that was no longer his character. He became a Christian, and he stopped doing that. And then that same day, we lost former NFL wide receiver David Patton, age 47, in an auto accident in Columbia, South Carolina. He played 13 seasons between the NFL and the Arena League, won 3 Super Bowls with the Patriots. Last Saturday, we lost former TV weatherman and the creator and original portrayer of the Ronald McDonald character, Willard Scott, at age 87 from natural causes. While he's most famous for being on the Today Show, he was also, as I said, the original Ronald McDonald. He also worked as a narrator for NASA's TV program, The Space Story. Ironically, he later did commercials for McDonald's competitor, Burger King. But he was also the Washington, D.C. affiliate, WRC. He was their incarnation of Bozo the Clown. Now look, Chicago area kids like me, brother Tommy, and others, we'll never acknowledge that there were other Bozo portrayers besides Bob Bell and Joey DiOrio. Be that as it may, he was a Bozo. And just to nip the chat room characters in the bud, there was never a swearing incident on Bozo. Remember the rumor, the urban legend that during the grand prize game, a kid missed bucket number 6 and said, "Shit!" And Bozo said, "Hey, that's a Bozo no-no." And then the kid retorted like, "Cram it, clowny." Never happened. In spite of the fact that I've met people from the age of 8 to the age of 88 who claim that they saw it live, but no, it did not happen. By the way, Bob Bell's version of Bozo also served as the inspiration for Krusty the Clown on The Simpsons. That's fact. That is fact. Bob Bell was Bozo. I mean, Joey DiOrio did a good job given what he had to do, but Bob Bell was Bozo. Let's face facts. Monday, we lost Emmy-nominated actor Michael K. Williams to a drug overdose at age 54. Quite naturally, the virtue signalers have taken to social media to tell us all how brilliant he was and how they have always followed him and spoke of his brilliance. Yeah, it's sad, but it's also a fact that whether it is sports or politics or entertainment or industry, there will always be drug overdoses. It's unfortunate and it's sad, but it's not a signal to lionize someone or worse, chastise the public at large for the scourge of drugs in our communities and our society. Yeah, people have done that too. We let him down by not getting him off drugs. Okay, yeah, thanks. Sorry, got to keep hydrated. I didn't hydrate enough over the weekend. On Monday, we also lost longtime Democrat politician Adlai Ewing Stevenson III. He was 90 from complications of dementia. He served in the Illinois House, the U.S. Senate. He was the Illinois treasurer for one term, and he ran for governor twice, losing both times to Big Jim Thompson. That was the last Republican governor of Illinois that actually had brains, I think. In addition to his great-grandfather and grandfather and father also all being career politicians, Adlai Stevenson was also the third cousin to McLean Stevenson, who famously portrayed Lieutenant Colonel Henry Blake on the TV series version of MASH. Yep, third cousins. And then yesterday we lost former USC and New England Patriots running back Sam Bam Cunningham at age 71. No cause was given. He was part of USC's 1972 national championship team. They beat Ohio State in the Rose Bowl. Cunningham scored four TDs. He did that launch. That came kind of cool. I think Brother Tommy and I did it in backyard football. We'd do the Sam Bam Cunningham launch. But he scored four TDs. Earlier that season, he'd rushed for 135 yards with two TDs against Alabama. And that allegedly led to Bear Bryant integrating Alabama's football program. A former assistant of his, Jerry Claiborne, who also was a head coach at Maryland at one time, he's said to have claimed that Sam Cunningham did more for integrating Alabama football in 60 minutes than Martin Luther King Jr. did in 20 years. That's kind of harsh, but he was also the older brother of former UNLV and NFL QB and punter Randall Cunningham. Okay, that's enough about death, isn't it? In politics, in what can I guess could be considered anything but a stunner, GOP Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says Dopey Joe will not be impeached simply because the votes aren't there. In somewhat of a stunner, though, McConnell said, "I think the way these behaviors get adjusted in this country is at the ballot box. There isn't going to be an impeachment." Kind of refreshing, kind of sick, coming, you know, considering who it came from, but kind of refreshing, I guess. Why the hell was Mitch McConnell when President Trump was being railroaded? Seriously, I mean, where the hell was he? Meanwhile, Georgia GOP Rep. Marjorie Taylor Greene did introduce three articles following the debacle in Afghanistan. In addition, Lindsey Graham and Georgia Representative Jody Heiss have called for impeachment or resignations of several La Dopey Nostra individuals or officials. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, and Joint Chiefs Chair General Mark Milley Vanilli have been called out. Meanwhile, Umjen Saki had this beauty when she was asked after the initial furor. Here's what she said. Politics. I think she should be a comedian. Seriously. Meanwhile, Dopey Joe says La Dopey Nostra will take a tougher stance toward meatpacking companies that La Dopey Nostra says are causing sticker shock at grocery stores. Seriously, the La Dopey Nostra says four main companies control the meatpacking market, and Don Giuseppe, a.k.a. Dopey Joe, blamed them for rising prices in a White House-maintained blog. No, I did not waste my time going to that blog. Hence, I can't vouch for whether or not it was done in finger paint by our alleged president. What I can tell you is that La Dopey Nostra plans to funnel. Gotta love that word when we're talking about our money. Yeah, anyway, the LDN plans to funnel $1.4 billion in COVID-19 pandemic stimulus money to small meat producers and workers. They also promised to, quote, crack down on illegal price fixing. Hey, morons, here's an idea. Open the economy. Stop playing around with the border. Get every American out of Afghanistan. Reinstitute the energy initiatives set forth by the Trump administration. Get people back to work. Quit with the green initiatives and stop disrupting supply lines with all the other regulatory crap. Do these people really think that it's going to be small meat producers and workers with $1.4 billion in vote Democrat bribe money that will bring down meat prices? One moron says that the four companies, quote, are, quote, collecting too much profit after the stimulus helped prop up demand for their product. Gee, you mean throwing money into the economy caused inflation? Say it ain't so. Yeah, Bharat Ramamurthy, he's the deputy director of the LDN's National Economic Council, he said, and you can't make this stuff up. He said, what we see here smacks of pandemic profiteering, and that is the behavior the administration finds concerning. God. Some U.S. lawmakers are seeking increased oversight of the beef sector as concerns about anti-competitive behavior increase after the pandemic, as well as a cyber attack on one of the companies, Brazil's American subsidiary, JBS SA. Really? It couldn't be rising gas prices. It couldn't be policies that literally just reversed everything that had been done well for the by the previous administration. No, it's pandemic profiteering. Why weren't they profiting through almost all of 2020 then? To a pandemic level, of course. Answer me that. Ground beef wasn't $4 a pound back in December. Not that I would know because I'm not buying ground beef right now. Because I personally prefer ground turkey because it loses less juice and fat when you cook it up. That's just me, though. Out in California, Santa Clara County is ignoring Supreme Court rulings protecting churches. How? By calling them businesses or citing services, church services, as, quote, commercial activity. They're doing this in order to levy fines of $2.8 million against churches for holding, quote, illegal indoor gatherings, unquote, during the pandemic. The two principal churches that are under attack are Calvary Chapel of San Jose and Southridge Church of San Jose. They noted the hypocrisy in the Santa Clara County order in May of 2020 that invoked a stay-at-home order and prohibited church gatherings, while at the same time, of course, allowing continued protests and riot activity under the guise of the First Amendment. Yeah, attorneys for the church in their June 2020 filing said that was, by the way, upheld by a Supreme Court. The county has publicly acknowledged that the right to attend protests regarding racial injustice is a, quote, fundamental right that is critical to the health of our democracy, unquote, yet it has not acknowledged the fundamental right to attend worship services. So, yeah, we'll see where that goes, but unbelievable they would actually do that. Who makes more money, you think, the average church or the average BLM or Antifa graft promoter, either one? Who do you think's raking in more? You're not seeing stories about all these pastors. You occasionally see it, and anytime you do see it, of course, it's trumpeted around the planet by big left and big media. But you don't see them about, you know, a local BLM leader with three houses or having a net worth of $1.5 million. You don't see that. Meanwhile, churches, no, they're not subject to the First Amendment in Santa Clara County, California, Stan. Oh, how about this? What about these communications between Dopey Joe and General Milli Vanilli and various Afghan officials? It's pretty clear that both of them, Dopey Joe and Milli Vanilli, that they urged then-Afghanistan President Ashraf Ghani to lie to various news agencies and officials about Taliban strength and the extent to which Taliban had taken over territories throughout the country. So the question is it an impeachable offense? Maybe. I don't know. Hawkeye Mike would answer that better. I guess anything's impeachable offense these days. The better alternative really is to investigate thoroughly and get info as widespread as possible. I mean, yeah, big media will continue to shill, no doubt. But as truth gets out, even big media eventually prints or reports facts. And the facts are what we need. Sure, I'm like a lot of others. I want the whole Biden administration gone. But maybe Mitch McConnell is right, really. I mean, maybe these things ultimately are resolved at the ballot box. Now, 2020 notwithstanding, yes, we need to be able to trust the election and the electoral process. There's no doubt about it. We need to know that widespread fraud and shoot-from-the-hip measures aren't allowed, whether it's ballot harvesting or fraudulent absentee ballots or on-the-spot machinery manipulation. Yeah, we need to know all that's gone. But in the end, our government and our elections and our whole country is a process. Just because Dems likely cheated and stole the election doesn't mean we go around calling for impeachment every time the La Dopey Nostra screws up. That's what they do. But given the frequency of those screw-ups, really, we don't have time to call them to everyone's attention. And frankly, that may just be one spot of brilliance on the part of Big Left. I mean, just keep everything moving. Good, bad, doesn't matter. Just get it all out there. The good ain't all that prevalent, so bad for the most part. Simply overload us with so much that come the next election cycle, the average American simply doesn't care enough to gather and assess relevant info. I mean, seriously. Instead, Big Left, they figure they're going to throw whatever information there is, good, bad, or indifferent, into the pot, turn up the heat, cook it at warp speed, and before you know it, all you really remember come election day, and this is the average voter, oh, yeah, that Biden is working hard. We should just keep him. That's literally what happens in too much of it. And believe it or not, friends, that kind of stuff works. And with the initial additional healthy dose of hiding or withholding the stuff that matters, they pull it off. I mean, not necessarily just in presidential elections, but across the country. And frankly, we cannot allow it to happen again. We've got to get control of Congress back come 2022. We've got to get true conservatives elected at local and state levels. It's not enough just to vote, you know, for your president every 4 years. You've got to keep local and state officials as conservatives. That's harder said than done, no doubt. But our local, our state reps, our U.S. reps, our senators, in the end, we got to hold all our leaders accountable, elected or appointed. And even that's not enough, because at some point we also got to hold media accountable too. And that probably is as big a challenge as any that we face. As Hawkeye Mike just messaged me, impeachment is supposed to be for high crimes and misdemeanors, but this has never been defined. The truth is that Congress can do what it wants if a majority of the House is inclined to impeach, as we saw last year and early this year with the totally vindictive Democrats. Exactly. And that's what they are. They're just vindictive. But that's as big a challenge as anything we face, is media control of information. It's not enough to just, you know, listen to me or Vito or Paul Sutliff. Or as Bigfoot, welcome Bigfoot, Indy Hawk, as I said, is already here. But it's not enough just to come in and join a chat room and listen and say, oh, we're going to care, you know, we're going to get the word out. People have to do it amongst ourselves too. I mean, I was at a wedding last weekend, so I did not do too much of, you know, the political thing. But you know what? When a few people asked me about it, I didn't hesitate to tell them what I thought. I didn't go around volunteering it, but I didn't hold back either. I mean, I didn't sit there and say, well, let's just leave it alone. It's a wedding. No, somebody wants to bring it up. Those of you that know me know I'm not about to keep my mouth shut. As I said, I want to welcome Indy Hawk, KB, and Bigfoot to the chat room. We've got several people on the phone lines as well. Got a 407 number, a couple of out-of-state ones, three of them I know. Big Sister's on, Brother Tommy's on, Hawkeye Mike's on. And then I got a 407, and if I look in my thing, I think I know who it is. But in any case, thanks for being here all, and those of you that are listening along but not playing along. That's fine, too. And again, you can always call in, 319-527-6706. If you do that, you can listen along. You can even hit the one and talk. If you want to email me, you can, but I, you know, hjpsports1980@gmail.com. And, of course, I'm on Twitter, at hpolysports. That's how I weekly give out. I send out my text to the people whose numbers I have, but I also, you know, on Twitter, that's where you'll see my thing. So, look, enough about politics for now. I'm just really tired of the political thing. And I'll tell you why a little bit later in the poly sports segment when I talk about my visit to Seattle. So let's start with the Iowa Hawkeyes. As most of you know, I was in Seattle area this past week for my daughter's wedding. A glorious week it was. Beautiful weather. Meeting my son-in-law's family in person, seeing my daughter and my son-in-law, the rehearsal, the wedding, the reception, several gatherings over the next few days, including a winery visit. I held it all together for those. I didn't overindulge, believe it or not. A little bit at the winery, but everybody did. We were just having fun. We weren't, you know, slosh, but we were pouring. We were pouring stuff. Chateau St. Michel, should bill them for this, but great wine. I know it's some would say, oh, it's big wine and, you know, it's mass produced. Well, to get widespread distribution to Florida from Washington, yeah, you kind of got to be that way. Nonetheless, great wine. I love their sparkling wine. That's sort of like my unofficial holiday sparkling wine. But we poured a bunch of them. We poured some Merlots. We poured some Cabs. Some you know, some, what else? Some rosé. Some of the folks were drinking rosés. And the rosé, they make a nice rosé, but I'm not usually a rosé drinker. So anyway, suffice it to say, I did not watch the game live. But I did listen on the Sirius XM app with headphones in my ears and people even asking me, how's the game going? And I followed along on the ESPN Gamecast. Let me tell you, although I am not surprised by a Hawkeye victory, I was not prepared for 34-6 over an Indiana team that looked really good in 2020. They almost came back against Ohio State, and then they faltered in their bowl game. But even that wasn't a shock. They lost their starting quarterback, Michael Penix, late in the season to a knee injury, and then his replacement got injured in the bowl game. Look, as much as we didn't need Hawkeye quarterback Spencer Petras to be dominant, and as much as our run game was very solid, as much as it helped having no interceptions by our quarterback, what really stood out to me was the defense. We had two pick sixes by Riley Moss. Defense frequently got pressure on Michael Penix up front. Linebacker play was become pretty typical for the Hawkeyes to have stellar linebacker play, but it was kind of surprising that Indiana just got two field goals out of this. Hawkeyes literally had control of the game within the first 3 or 4 minutes. And after watching the game highlights on YouTube and elsewhere, it's easy to see that this defense is good. It was a worry coming into the season, but this defense is good. But still, the offense is underrated. Tyler Goodson had a 56-yard touchdown to open scoring. It was textbook blocking. They set up the run lanes, got their outside contained to commit inside, and that broke him free. And you're not going to catch Tyler Goodson down the sideline. Even Spencer Petras' TD on a quarterback draw was set up brilliantly by the sequence of plays preceding it. Brian Ferentz has gotten a lot better in the games that he's calling. Some of Spencer's throws were off, but some were also excellent. He used both his tight ends. He got multiple tight ends in there. He got the ball to several wide receivers. About the only complaint, we didn't get any connection on any true deep balls. But, again, Indiana has had, for the last couple seasons, a really good pass defense. Now, for some other observations, who at Indiana is responsible for spelling the name Indiana on their jerseys? Any of you guys notice this? Indy, did you notice? Or it said I-N-D-I-N-I-A, Indinia. That had to be embarrassing. My God. It probably is a harbinger for the whole day. Tyler Goodson and Ivory Kelly Martin both ran well, although after the early TD, Indiana did better against the run. Still, both Tyler Goodson and Ivory Kelly Martin have good vision and good speed, and the OL, the offensive line, is going to open some good holes this year. Offensive line may not have been dominant, but like I mentioned, the run blocking was good. The protection in the pocket for Spencer Petras was pretty darn good. It was definitely there. It's sometimes hard to understand what a great job they do, because we simply come to expect that at Iowa. But this offensive line has good chemistry and they work well together, no matter who seems to be on the field right now. Spencer Petras, as I said, made good throws and decisions. He'll continue to improve. He's improved all through his career thus far. And once that first true deep ball is hit, things are going to open up more. He hit some great throws to his tight ends. He did a good job using the running backs out of the backfield when things weren't open. Whether they went for yardage wasn't the issue. He recognized it. He didn't just throw the ball away. The wide receivers have speed. They run some good routes. As teams start to focus more on the tight ends, by necessity, they're going to have to. Wide receivers are going to have more opportunities. Defensive line was the surprise for me. Three starters had to be replaced. Yet there really wasn't, to me, that big of a drop-off from last year. Our ends got good pressure. They maintained contain. And frankly, the linebackers and defensive backs are something else. The speed is noticeable. They have a nose for the ball. Justin Jacobs, very reminiscent of Chad Greenway for Hawkeye fans. That same sort of angular build, the really surprising quickness and speed that you don't really usually see from an Iowa linebacker. Excellent instincts to the ball. Yeah, he's going to be a star before he leaves Iowa City to play in the NFL. And yes, he will play in the NFL. Some other games, we had several upsets, including three FCS teams that took down Power 5 teams. None was more eye-opening than the one Saturday in Seattle, though. The FCS, otherwise known as Division 1 AA, Montana Grizzlies, down 20th-ranked Washington, 13-7. Now, the beauty is the fact that, as I said, my son-in-law and five of his are They were even joking with me beforehand about how this is their moneymaker game, just getting paid $500,000 to $1 million to get crushed by Washington. Lo and behold, they come out on top in a huge upset. Another kind of upset. After a big win against Nebraska in week zero, Illinois tossed away any momentum they had with a loss to Texas San Antonio, who's actually not a bad team, by the way. They've had some big wins over the last few years, but man, Illinois at home, after the momentum you got from the first game, North Carolina got the preseason hype, and Sam Howell, their quarterback, got some Heisman love. That went bye-bye with their opening game loss to Virginia Tech, which, by the way, that might have saved head coach Justin Fuente's job for Virginia Tech, if he can build on that. Oklahoma barely escaped with Tulane. They won 40-35 after leading 37-14 at half. Yes, Georgia-Clemson was a big game, but unfortunately with the 10-3 Georgia win, we're back to SEC holding the top two spots in the rankings. Iowa State held on to beat Northern Iowa 16-10. Coincidentally, Penn State held on to beat Wisconsin by the same score in Madison. Good win for the Nittany Lions. UCLA pulled off an upset. They beat LSU out in Los Angeles 38-27. Notre Dame took down Florida State in overtime. More on that later, though. There's a great story within that game. Some injuries. Bama lost outside linebacker Chris Allen. Clemson lost safety Landon Zanders. Michigan lost wide receiver Ronnie Bell. And Minnesota lost 2020 Big Ten Running Back of the Year Mo Ibrahim to injuries for the rest of the season. I'd say the two Big Ten losses are the most crucial to their respective teams, although Washington lost their number four wide receiver, which you'd say, really? But their top three wide receivers are week to week, so that could be huge for them. UConn fell to FCS Holy Cross, which prompted head coach Randy Edsall of UConn to announce his retirement at the end of the season. That is until the university subsequently announced it effective immediately, with defensive coordinator Lou Spanos taking over as interim head coach. Randy Edsall, it's his second go-round at UConn. It did not go well. On top of the way things ended for him at Maryland, if you'll remember, they had a player that suffered heat stroke or heat exhaustion in camp, and, you know, they were under fire for how that was handled and how they didn't protect the players, et cetera. So, yeah, I'd say it's safe to say this is a true retirement for him, at least from coaching. The Gus Malzahn era started at UCF, although it was lightning delayed by a few hours after spotting Boise State a 21-0 lead, and we talked about that last week on the show when I called in. The Knights came back for a nice win, 36-31. The possible invite to join the Big 12 also has things looking pretty good for them, trending in the right direction. And it really makes South Florida look stupid. Several years ago, South Florida blocked UCF's entry into the old Big East, which then eventually crumbled. And USF just looks, I mean, they're slinking along in the AAC, the American Conference. And frankly, if UCF and Cincinnati and Houston all head to the Big 12 along with BYU, it looks even worse for South Florida. This is a team that not that long ago, under head coach Jim Leavitt, a former Hayden Fry assistant, they'd actually gotten to a number two national ranking. Yeah, when the bottom drops out at a mid-major, though, it can take forever to get that ship righted, really. Two feel-good stories. Zeb Nolan, he started this season as a graduate assistant at South Carolina. He became their starting quarterback last weekend. The starter went down in camp. And Nolan actually had eligibility. Now, he backed up Fall for their one appearance. He backed up Trey Lance at North Dakota State. And Trey Lance was the third pick in this year's draft of the 49ers. Well, then when they did spring football, Zeb Nolan became their starter. Now suddenly the guy's a six-year senior starter with an FBS win under his belt. So take that, Trey Lance. And then the other one, of course, Mackenzie Milton. For those that don't know, remember back when UCF had a couple of undefeated regular seasons? In fact, in the one season, they beat Auburn in the Peach Bowl, I think it was. Mackenzie Milton was their quarterback. for those two seasons. And then in the final regular season game against South Florida over in Tampa, gruesome, horrific injury, absolutely awful injury. And I was one of those idiots who made the mistake of going online to look at it. Yeah, don't ever go online and do Joe Theismann. There's no reason for it, folks. There's just not. It's so grim. Anyway, doctors weren't sure he'd keep his leg, let alone walk. And certainly they weren't expecting him to play football. He suffered, like I said, surgery in Tampa, subsequent surgeries, infection. That was back in November of 2018. And then once Dylan Gabriel kind of established himself as the new quarterback at UCF, Milton did come back last season, but Trent didn't play, so he transferred to Florida State. And he did not get the start Sunday night against Notre Dame, but he did come in when their starter, Jordan Travis, lost his helmet on a play. So he promptly brings him back from a 10-point deficit to a tie, forces overtime. And here's where it gets really odd. He had a play in overtime that they at first ruled a fumble, but then their coach challenged it and that it should have been an incomplete pass, so the line of scrimmage moved back. So FSU's kicker hits a long field goal in overtime, like a 50-yarder, but their head coach, Mike Norvell, had challenged the spot. So it was a closer spot, and the kicker promptly missed the next attempt, and then Notre Dame got a field goal in overtime to win it. But make no mistake, Mackenzie Milton is back. He looks poised, and he may very well make a big difference for Florida State this season. Frankly, it's a comeback that was well-earned and well-deserved. So here's to him having a great season, really. I'm going to take a quick break, then I'll come back with my Poly Sports segment. And then if anyone wants to call in, for those of you that want to talk Hawkeye Cyclone football, that is this weekend. And, yeah, we are going to – you know I'm going to talk about it. So little Jeff Beck to keep you company. We'll be right back. Thank you, Jeff Beck. We're back. I am Hank Jones, and you are listening to Hank Jones Poly Sports on Global Patriot Radio here at blogtalkradio.com. The number to call, 319-527-6706. Of course, you can log in online, get in the chat room. Email me anytime, hjpsports1980@gmail.com. I'm on Twitter, at hpolysports. I'm on Facebook. Just type in Hank Jones Polysports. I don't do much on Facebook, admittedly. I do on Twitter. What I'm usually doing on Twitter, in addition to putting my show link in, is just kind of retweeting interesting stuff. There's so much good stuff on there that you can find. You don't need me trying to report news. You know, you just want me and my snarky attitude about it. I'm going to do a quick Polysports segment before I bring on Hawkeye Mike, who I see as punched in, ready to go. And Brother Tommy said he was going to, and I wish he would. This segment deals with two things, really. The ongoing COVID pandemic and the government mismanagement that's resulted. I'll start with an article from the Epoch Times. I know I'm not here to read, but I just want to point out a couple things about it. Basically, it's the COVID death stuff and the COVID admittances to hospitals continue to be manipulated and maneuvered. This article talks about someone with a pancreas disorder admitted as a COVID patient because then the doctor claims it gets them treatment faster. Huh? Statistically, you know, we know that Israel, for instance, has what, 75 to 80% vaccination rate, and yet most of their admittances are people that are vaccinated. Now, I got vaccinated. I'm not arguing that. But sounds like, the boosters better be good. Now, J&J, that's the one I have, they say their booster is actually very good. An Orange County, Florida guy died last year in a motorcycle crash. It was originally considered a COVID death before investigations by various media got its classification changed. A medical age construction worker fell off a ladder in Croatia and was counted as a COVID death. I mean, you know, you saw those memes for a while, shark attack victims, you know, those kinds of things. I mean, it's just gone on for too long. Well, the management, the government mismanagement is what I'm going to get to it, the government side of it. And I caution you, this is only anecdotal and only from my perspective. But at age 59, I think I am observant enough to at least give the impressions that I've gotten. Okay, start with all the CARES Act and the PPP money, the EIDL, Economic Injury Disaster. What was the point? I mean, why were we seeing shuttered businesses get loans while at the same time employment benefits were increased to the point that people didn't even want to go back to work? Disconnect there maybe? Or how about the massage spa on the West Coast that got reported? And it was thrown out, by the way, but it was reported by employees who lost their unemployment benefits when the spa, after receiving PPP funds, gave their workers the good news. Yeah, some of those employees actually filed complaints against the employer. Or how about those that received funds fraudulently, the guy that had gotten like $3.2 million, or who were simply large businesses, some of them publicly traded, who, by the way, presumably have access to emergency funding that small businesses do not? How about the fact entertainers and celebrities and sports teams and the like received funding? Again, there's a huge difference between an NBA franchise and a mom-and-pop AC and a heating business or a local plumber or even a small independent medical office. How about business closings? Remember the phrase essential businesses? And remember restaurants being limited, usually to takeout only and no bar service? Grocery stores were open. So was Walmart. So was Home Depot. Of course, Amazon never closed. But again, what about the small mom-and-pop hardware store or sporting goods store? What about the barbecue restaurant run by local Larry or the small Mexican restaurant owned and run by a hardworking family just doing their best to survive versus the franchise or the corporate-owned barbecue or Mexican restaurant that had access to all the personal protective equipment, large-scale access to sanitation and cleaning supplies? And yet, we still have seen large retail businesses get hit hard as well. Travel and tourism, think about this. Much of the travel and tourism dollars come from overseas. Now, President Trump, rightly so, enacted travel bans at various times. Now, he was initially called racist and xenophobic by Big Left, categorically classified him as ignorant and inactive and didn't do anything at all. And yet when Plastic Pelosi said, come to Chinatown, or Kaiser Wilhelm de Blasio was shown working out in the New York City gyms, or Fauci was telling us we didn't need to alter our behavior, including wearing masks. Remember that? Big Left said the virus was, quote, ever-evolving. Now, make no mistake, the virus was not ever-evolving for President Trump. But, of course, travel and tourism has felt a huge impact. The cruise industry may never recover, certainly not for, you know, a while. Hotels are not seeing full occupancy. Hotel restaurants aren't seeing full capacity, and they are on an ongoing basis at the mercy of our local government and health officials when it comes to remaining open and doing business. Being out in Seattle, they've reinstituted indoor masks, and any outdoor venue with more than 500 people also requires masks, which brings me to what I saw in Seattle this past weekend. Now, business closings, tent cities and local landmarks, tons of homeless along closed storefronts, lighting up the weed. That's a personal thing, but you know, even the Pike Place Market looks tired. Now, if you've been to Seattle and been to the Pike Place Market, it's an awesome place, but it looks tired. I'm not sure how Seattle comes back from this. Their leadership is atrocious. I'm not sure if their business climate can ever recover. I mean, the storefronts looked awful, the vacant ones. They've got a higher minimum wage. They've already got a high cost of living. So why would a business go back into downtown Seattle when they can go 20 miles outside? There's no telling how much farther left this place goes anyway, with self-admitted communists in their city and county government. While the CHOP zone seems to be back in the hands of government, nearby Pioneer Square, and Pioneer Square is a beautiful downtown pedestrian mall area. It's got firefighter monuments, early pioneers that are recognized. It's where the underground tour begins. It's now literally a tent city. I mean, for Hawkeyes on the that are listening, think of the pedestrian mall in front of the old Fieldhouse and Maxwell's in that area. Think of that as a tent city. That's what's happened. Seriously, I mean, a city that prides itself on diversity and tolerance and inclusivity and being service-oriented to the homeless and the disadvantaged is anything but diverse-looking. I mean, homelessness is rampant throughout the city, and the minority portion of it isn't really a minority. It's mainly minorities that are on the street, but not all. I took a pair of old running shoes along, planning to wear them around for the weekend, then I was going to give them to a pantry or a shelter, you know, that gives them to people. I had a choice of about 20 homeless people I encountered on the streets who did not have shoes. I finally found a guy who accepted the shoes. They were close enough in size, although he really admitted what he really wanted was cash, which is kind of odd, by the way, considering I also encountered a large number of businesses that weren't taking cash. I chalked that up partly to COVID, but maybe not. I mean, after all, what's the best way to keep down an upwardly motivated person if they can't spend what it is they earn anyway without either incurring credit card debt or being trackable through debit or prepaid cards? I mean, this is tragic, but it's also sad and pathetic. I mean, for a city with such a nice historic downtown, as well as beautiful surroundings geographically, I would be hard-pressed to call parts of it nicer than Gary, Indiana, or East St. Louis, Illinois, at least in parts. But guess what? Average rent for an 800-square-foot apartment in Seattle is $2,034, and that's a 4% decrease from last year. But now, suburban and outlying areas are slightly cheaper, but those costs are rising in double digits. I mean, what the hell? How does this happen? And I'll tell you how. It is deliberate, malevolent mismanagement. It is utter disregard for everyone and everything but oneself on the part of leadership. And despite its constant cries of conservatives being heartless, no single city embodies selfishness and heartlessness like Big Left in Seattle. I mean, none. None. Okay, going to bring in Brother Tommy and Hawkeye Mike. Mike, how you doing?
Pretty good, Hank. How's it going?
Brother Tommy, you in?
I'm here.
Okay, so you guys saw the game last week. Mike, you sent me a message that you thought Petras got a little bit bad, didn't get a good shake, that he did a lot better than people were saying. So what are your observations? Start with the offense.
Offense, well, you know, I think that, of course, that's what's been getting the criticism on the Iowa end, that they weren't up to snuff. But I think you have to give some context to this game. It was like 31-3 by halftime. Game was over. He had two pick sixes. The offense didn't have to do much, and they didn't have to show much. And I would point out a couple other things, too. Petras did not have a turnover. He took care of the ball, which is an important thing for a college football quarterback, especially in the first game of the year. It'll be important next this coming week against Iowa State, because in that I saw a recent statistic when Iowa's won five in a row, and one of the big reasons is because there's a huge turnover margin between Iowa and Iowa State, where Iowa State's had a lot more turnovers, and there's been a couple of close games. You remember the last game when they fumbled the punt at the end of the game, for example. But I would point out a couple things about Petras. He was 13 out of 27, which is pretty unremarkable passing. There were at least three or four drops where the ball was right on target and, you know, just dropped, you know, by the receivers. He did underthrow badly a pass that would have been a sure six. And there was another longer pass that he also underthrew. He was on the run, though, a little bit, throwing against the grain. That the guy was wide open. So you could put those two things on him. I think I'm not too worried. I think he'll improve on that. I go by the way he finished the year last year, which I think was where he had six touchdowns, one interception, well over 60% completion rate. So after a slow start last year, he picked things up. I expect him to play better against Iowa State in the coming weeks. But, Iowa was not in a position offensively where they really had to do much. And, you know, especially the first game of the year, if you don't have to show too much, you know, the game's over with pretty much, which it was at halftime. You kind of keep it close to the vest. So yeah. There was a couple drives that were killed by two fumbles by the running backs, one by Goodson, one by Ivory Martin. The latter was inside. I think he fumbled right around the Iowa State 20. And both of those looked like pretty promising drives that were killed. So this game could easily have been 41-6, 48-6, something like that. But, you know, Ferentz has never been one to run the score up. They got the lead, and they kind of sat on it. They didn't show much offensively. So, I'm not people that getting a little nervous about the offense, I would just say this, calm down. I'm not worried.
Yeah. Yeah. If you don't have to show, then there's no reason to. Brother Tommy, what's your thought?
Well, I'll play devil's advocate a little bit, partly because it makes it more interesting for the listener and mainly because I believe it. We could not run between the tackles. You can get away with that. You get two pick sixes and a 54-yard scamper. We did not run between the tackles. I do not share Hawkeye Mike's – I kind of do assessment with Petras, but I don't totally share it. I thought it was god-awful. The Tyrone Tracy pack, Hawkeye pass, Hawkeye Mike alluded to, absolutely no excuse. It wasn't a 23-yard pass. It was a 9-10-yard pass, and it's at his feet. There's really no excuse for that.
No, there was another pass that he underthrew to somebody that was wide open. No, I agree with you totally on the one to Tracy. That was just a bad play by Petras.
That to me is was unexcusable. I agree with you. I'll tell you what, against Iowa State, he better play better. Second half, we scored 3 points. Yeah, 3 points. We had one sustained drive. The one where Petras ended up doing a fantastic quarterback draw and got in the end zone. That was good. Other than that, I didn't see any sustained drives. Obviously, he had the Goodson run, but you take away that run, and Goodson averaged, I believe, 2.5 yards or thereabouts. So unless we can run between the tackles.
But why take it away?
What's that?
Why take away the 56-yard run?
Because it was an aberration. There was no one on the out. There was no one on the outside. It was an aberration. It was a defensive malfunction, and so it was a gift, just like the pick sixes. They were gifts.
Well, that's why I take it away. Wait a minute. A defensive malfunction. Maybe it was just a good blocking scheme by Iowa. caught Indiana off guard. By the way,
it absolutely
Indiana's
was
got a good defense.
Yeah, they do. That play was masterfully done, because what they did, they dragged the two tight ends in together, making it look like
the
play was going
about 20
yeah.
times. I've seen the play about 20 times.
But I haven't recorded it.
They're absolutely wrong there. You're assessing it wrong.
No, they dragged
his job is to force him in the inside.
Right.
Totally
but guess what? Because with bringing the two tight ends together like that, they literally looked for the inside draw, or not draw, but the inside route. And he overcommitted. He overcommitted because the two tight ends did their job. And no, I think it was a masterful play.
This is my argument. And you take it. And I agree with that. Barry Sanders, 2 yard gain, 2 yard gain, 2 yard gain, 84 yard gain. I understand that. But my point is, we didn't run between the tackles. And I just didn't see any running game. I don't think the run blocking was good. I think the pass blocking was surprisingly good. I put A-plus for the defense. I put C-minus for the offense. Are they things that
can
be correct?
Well, first of all, Tom, wait a minute. You're not giving – Indiana's got a good defense, and we knew that going on. Now, Iowa State's got a good defense, and they showed it against you and I. It was their offense that was anemic. By the way, you know, kind of coincidence. You know, it's not that unusual that the defenses are a little ahead of the offenses at the beginning of the year. But I think you got to give Indiana. They were 6-2 last year. They had a very good defense. I think they do have a good defense. But I think, you know, the difference there was that Iowa's defense was dominant and shut down a Indiana offense that was expected to be pretty explosive.
Yeah,
I get the Iowa defense at A+.
So let's go to the defense, Tom. What stood out to you on defense?
One of the ones you mentioned, Jacobs, thought he was fantastic. What's his name? Benson had a tremendous game. Campbell, I'm talking linebackers for those who don't know what I'm talking about. Campbell was surprisingly silent. Everyone thought he was going to be the super stud. Jacobs, as you pointed out, Hank, short of injury, is going to be playing on Sundays. There's no doubt about that. He had a cutback where he had a couple of just plays that were busy. He was a physical freak. So he's going to
He literally, when I saw the one where he broke in and then pursued the runner outside and nailed him, I thought I said, Chad Greenway. Tall, an angular build, not a big, bulky linebacker like we usually. It was like watching Chad Greenway, and I'll bet he may be as fast as Chad Greenway was. I don't know that. But.
I wouldn't be surprised if he's faster. DBs, I thought, looked fantastic. Moss was, he was lucky on the first interception, and, the second one, he timed it perfectly. I thought the DBs were great, and I've got a lot of positivity going into Saturday. I just I don't care. Bama, Ohio State. I'm saying we're talking about a team that we all think could be really that blue blood level this year, and you don't score 3.5 points with that. I don't care if you're not going to show anything. Hell, Walsh would tell people what he's going to run. You've got to execute it. It doesn't matter if they know what you're going to run. If you execute it, you're going to do it better than they do. And that's all I'm saying is between the tackles. If you cannot run between the tackles, you will not consistently win ball games. Dave wants
I just think you're getting a little carried away here.
I think you guys are getting carried away by being overly positive. It's just a counterpoint.
Is there room for improvement on offense? Of course, I think so. But I think that it's easy to nitpick. And if you go on to Hawkeye Nation, or if you go on to Cake or Iowa Rivals, you'll see the same type of stuff that we just heard Tom spiel out here in the last couple minutes.
Yeah.
Well, what you do, Mike, when you assess something, it's an interesting choice of word, nitpick. I think that's how you assess a ball game. That's what you do. You nitpick. You don't throw out all the Pollyanna bowls.
So
it's easy to say the Hawks
game.
Are great. They're going to win the national championship. What's that?
So wait.
Well, I don't think we know who's going to win the national championship, but I do think Iowa can go pretty far this year, and I wouldn't make any predictions on that yet, but let's see how it goes. What I saw made – I thought overall, if you talked to me before the game and then after the game, I was a lot higher on the Hawkeyes after the game than going in.
As was I.
And I was high on them going in.
So, Mike, what did you think? Mike, what about your observations on defense? What did you see, Mike, that Tom and I didn't see?
I expected the linebackers and the defensive backs to be good. I mean, they had almost everybody back from a pretty stellar defense last year. The thing that really surprised me pleasantly, and I think Tom touched on this, and I agree with him, was the defensive line play, which they consistently got pressure on Penix, and they shut down the run. And that was the biggest question mark on the whole Iowa team this year was their defensive line because they were all new. And so I was really pleasantly surprised by how the defensive line performed. And, you know, hopefully they can keep that going because if they can put pressure on Purdy, Purdy will make mistakes and will throw interceptions. So we'll see if they're able to do that. And I'm pretty, I think with the defense Iowa has, even a mediocre offense, they're going to be in every game.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I amplify the point. That, to me, was the biggest pleasant surprise, what Mike just said, our defensive line. I don't care who you were. I don't even care if you were one of the coaches. Everyone had to be surprised about how well they played. Everyone.
Yeah.
They weren't.
Definitely. I was. I really was.
I was, too.
So we got two key games this weekend that involve ranked teams, or, you know, both teams are ranked. You got number 12 Oregon at number 3 Ohio State. Ohio State's got two extra days rest because they played last Thursday against Minnesota, and Oregon didn't exactly dominate Fresno State. Plus, Ohio State is absolutely loaded at receiver. I mean, I'm surprised that they all stayed. I'm surprised you didn't have any that left early. But, I mean, it's at OSU, so that's going to be, you know, that's an Ohio State win. But from that Ohio State game, the Minnesota lost Muhammad Ibrahim. What do you think their season's over?
Not over, but it's certainly hurt. Ohio State, I said on your show last week, Hank, to Vito, your guest host, who did a great job, that Ohio State was going to walk through the West. I'm going to recant that. They've got defensive issues. Now, they have three of the best receivers in the freaking country, let alone the Big Ten. So offensively, they're going to be a juggernaut. But defensively, I was not impressed. And Ibrahim, I'll give Hawk on Mike before, but Ibrahim, that is a colossal loss. It's colossal loss. It's huge. It's like losing Tom Brady 10 years ago. It's huge.
Yeah.
No, I agree. I actually agree on that. I think that Minnesota actually, was pretty impressive.
I agree.
Overall.
I agree.
Playing Ohio State as they did, Ohio State just had too much on offense. And once Stroud kind of got settled down, they were just couldn't stop them. But the loss of Ibrahim. I mean, that guy really had a good game. Until he got hurt, and that's a really tough loss for Minnesota. I don't know who their, I don't off the top of my head recall who their backup is, but I actually that game's going to be against Iowa.
Well, I think after 17 years, Shannon Brooks finally moved on from Minnesota. God, that guy was there forever, but I think I noticed that his name didn't pop up, so he must not have taken the COVID year. So,
yeah.
Okay. So this weekend now, what do we need to do to win? I mean, I didn't watch. Did you watch much of the? Did either of you watch much of the Iowa State game? I did not see any of it. So,
I couldn't even get it. I saw people on the board.
It was on the internet stuff. My brother is a big Iowa State fan, and I was. I was talking to him during the game some, and they were not happy. If you talk to any honest Iowa State fan. They were not happy about, and I'll be kind to Iowa State here. They were not happy about how they played. I think they were surprised at the difficulty they had with you and I. Maybe they shouldn't have been, but they were. And I frankly expected Iowa State to roll against you and I, but their offense was a problem. I think their defense played pretty good. You and I really didn't do much. They had one big play. That was about it. And but Iowa State's offense, they were down inside the 5 at the 1. They couldn't get it in. They're playing you and I. I mean, that's just –
yeah.
But
Breece Hall running for 3 yards
yeah,
of carry.
Breece Hall didn't do that good, yeah. Here's the key, though. Here's the thing that we have to remember. Iowa State will play better Saturday. They will be up. they're coming off a, you know, they're going to be fired up. They're tired of losing to Iowa. Iowa better be ready for, you know, Iowa State's best, because I think I expect Iowa State to play much better on offense.
Yeah.
It's going to be a test for Iowa. I think Iowa can win.
I'll throw out the caveat.
But it's going to be a tough game.
Yeah, I'll
What's
throw out
caveat?
The caveat right now. The caveat is, if you're going to underestimate Iowa State, this is the caveat. All you got to do is think Iowa Hawkeyes 2009. They almost lost to Iowa State, subsequently went to the Orange Bowl and beat Georgia Tech. I'm pretty sure that was the year. Now,
no, almost lost
almost
to UNI.
Lost.
No, we almost lost to UNI.
That's what I meant. That's
yeah,
what I meant.
UNI. Right.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm saying anyone that looked at the score this last Saturday between Iowa State and UNI and says, oh, that's indicative of anything, is out of their mind. It is indicative of nothing. Iowa State will show up. It's my personal belief, and I'm always side with my Hawkeyes. I think we're going to beat them. But if anyone thinks
and,
they're
and,
not
and the bottom line is Iowa State got the win. You know, that's the bottom line.
Yeah, yeah. As did we in 2009. Exactly. And you know damn well they're not showing anything. This Saturday is their Super Bowl. Every year. I don't care if it's Campbell. I don't care who the coach is. This Saturday is their Super Bowl. They're playing for this Saturday. They probably didn't even game prep for you and I. They've probably been spending the last 3 weeks on Iowa. So, no, anyone that thinks you can take them lightly because they only beat you and I by a touchdown or 6 points, whatever it was, is out of their gourd. It's going to be a brawl. It's going to be a brawl.
By the way, now it's going to get a little tough on Iowa State, and it's not about their football team. But, you know, you got game day coming in Saturday, which is great. But like someone pointed out on one of the – I think it was on Caker's side, they had an interesting thing about how they can thank Iowa for bringing game day in to Ames for the second time in 3 years or whatever. I was there 2 years ago. I was in Ames. And, you know, we all know what happened as far as the, you know, longest game of the year. Hopefully they won't have that issue. But
I stopped doing shots at 9 o'clock at night.
Yeah. Let me just say, I got to tell you, and this is firsthand experience, right? Well, first of all, you guys remember this, I'm sure. There was a big incident with the Iowa band at the game two years ago where basically a couple band members were almost pretty much assaulted by a couple of drunk-ass, douchebag Iowa State fans. And, I mean, it was a big deal. And, I mean, and it was just total Bush League. And I have to tell you, as a personal experience, and I was sitting in the, you know, there for the whole game, some of these Iowa State fans are the biggest bunch of douchebags you will ever see. I've been around a lot of fans, and they're about the worst. Part of it is the little brother mentality and the fact that they can't win. But they were acting like complete assholes. You remember how that game went 2 years ago? Iowa was behind most of the way. And then they in the second half, made a couple plays. Offensive line started taking over. You remember, like, Nate Stanley was doing, like, 10-yard quarterback sneaks and couldn't stop him. And Iowa won the game. And it went from, you know, the total festivities and acting like complete assholes and you know, yelling. You know, I'm sitting there as an Iowa fan wearing my Iowa stuff, having to take it. You know, it looked like Iowa State was a better team. Then when Iowa made the comeback and kind of started dominating the game, it got real quiet.
Yeah.
And some of these drunk-ass assholes, you know, just kind of faded away. Now, I don't know what's going to happen Saturday, but I'm just giving you guys a flavor
That punt return was the most glorious ending to a game, you know, because we were punting and it looked like, you know we didn't have Torrey Taylor, but our punting wasn't as good then. It wasn't bad, but it wasn't Rastetter.
Well, they
were
going to have about 2 minutes. They were going to have about 2 minutes to drive.
Yeah, you know, there were people still days later from Iowa State that were questioning whether that was the right call, like whether we should have gotten the ball after that and all that stuff, you know, saying, oh, arguably it was roughing the receiver, you know, catch interference. And it was like, man, get over it. Your guy.
Well,
I mean, it was hilarious. It really was. Well, in answer to this, because you were there, I had also heard that during, you know, several of the different breaks, that Iowa State fans were trying to run onto the field and, like, sliding in the rain, or was that not on the field?
No, I think I forgot about that, but I think there was a little bit of that. You know, remember, we had hours of delay while it was, like, raining torrents, and then it would clear for a few minutes, but they were expecting more rain, and then the rain would come. And, you know, let me just tell you, that was about the worst football game experience of my life, you know, 7 hours at that stadium.
Yeah.
Among a bunch of douchebag Iowa State fans. Not, you know. The only thing that was great was it all paid off at the end. So let's hope that happens this year.
Hey, Hank, let me quickly get tangential on something that Hawkeye Mike just said. I didn't know that Iowa State fans were that big of a douches, but you got to give credit. T. Bodie, one of the frequent listeners, callers, Hank and I were at the and our respective wives were at the Capital One Bowl, and I think it was 06.
05.
Other than that one douche, which you remember, Hank, that one douche, other than that, kind of the antithesis of what Mike just said about Iowa State, I have such respect for LSU fans. It's ridiculous.
Absolutely.
Remember how gracious they were? We were walking back, and they're like, hey, great game, blah, blah, blah. We had that one douche, but that was before the game, and he was so fucking liquored up. Hell, he made me blush, you know. But other than that, don't you think, Hank, and I don't want to get too tangential, but don't you think they were the most gracious, coolest fans?
Absolutely they were. And I've never – I mean, I have heard of Iowa State fans being problematic, but, I mean, I've heard of other fans that are just as bad. So, I mean, that's not really –
I heard Wisconsin's very bad. I heard Wisconsin –
Yeah, Wisconsin, I've only been at Wisconsin one time, and that my problem with Wisconsin had nothing to do with the fans. It had to do with the fact that I went in there with a T-shirt in October against – you know, in Madison – and didn't think anything of the fact that it would be windy as a maniac off of those lakes and that I would be freezing to death by the time that game ended. I thought I was going to die. I really did. I mean, it was like everybody's like, oh.
The other good one is Michigan, but they're all fucking doped up on Prozac and shit. They're the mildest fan base I've ever seen.
I know. Remember, I went there with a neighbor.
My experience
brother
Ohio
Tommy.
State fans are not good either. Anything that goes, you know, they expect to win every game, sort of probably like Alabama fans.
Yeah.
But if they get any kind of adversity, like I remember a game years ago, Iowa was playing, and it was a close game. Iowa, you might remember, I think it was a game in Columbus where Iowa scored on a fake field goal, and Nate Kading ran it in or something like that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I was in this sports bar with all these Ohio State guys wearing their. I have to say it, they're fucking obnoxious red shirts all over the place.
Yeah.
And when that play happened, I don't know why, but it really set me off. They all started screaming. Anytime a bad play or play goes against them, it's a penalty, you know, holding. They didn't call a holding. Yeah, you can say that on every damn play.
Yeah,
I'm sorry,
but
these Ohio State fans did not impress me, at least the ones I was.
Because there is holding on every damn play. Quickly interject.
Bigfoot pointed out in the chat room, West Virginia fans can be pretty bad. I think, you know, I think of that. Well, he's a Hokie, so I can understand that where he's coming from.
And then there are Nebraska fans, which is a whole
different. Yeah, no,
that's what I was going to ask you. Speaking of red shirts, have you been to Lincoln?
No, I haven't been to Lincoln, but I've been to games in Ames and Iowa City with Nebraska involved, and I've seen I have people I know who are Nebraska fans who they honk their horn and the Nebraska fight song comes on, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And
right.
So, yeah, I know Nebraska, the fandom pretty well.
Yeah.
I think
if you live in Nebraska, you don't really have anything else, right?
Right.
I'll tell you something else.
Exactly,
though. You know, you talk about
Iowa's a sports haven.
You were talking about Michigan. You know, I went to a game in Michigan Stadium in 1979, and it was against Indiana, and they actually won on the last play of the game. Anthony Carter, I think, was a freshman or sophomore. But that fan base, I mean, for a stadium that holds 100-some thousand, and most of the stadium is below ground level. I think only 17 rows are above ground level.
That's what kills the noise. That's what kills the noise.
But I can know, because they can still be, but they're just not. I mean, I was shocked, and it's nothing like, you know, you hear about Penn State or other huge
fans. They look like they're all on Prozac. They look like they're all on Prozac. They just have this dumb little thing, and they really, I mean, it's just like they clap, but it's almost like they're robotic. It's just a weird thing to watch. I mean, they'll scream every once in a while, but it's like they win the national championship on January 9. They don't even know they won the national championship. They're all doped up.
Well, I think that's part of the other problem is that people talk about Nebraska fans being quote unquote self-righteous and self-deserving and living in the past. Michigan fans are still not over the fact, one, they haven't beat Ohio State since, what was it, like 2000?
Eisenhower administration.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, they haven't beat them in that long.
The Lloyd Carr years.
Yeah, no, I think it was. I think it was like 2011 or 12 when Ohio State had that hiccup year.
Brady Hoke won one.
Yeah. But I heard it. It's like been like 3,700 days or something. There's that, but they just don't. Yeah, they're not aware of the fact that they're not as relevant as they were 30 years ago. And I think that's part of it. You know, that's just they just don't get it. You know, so it's you know. But no, I don't know.
No,
I just,
my impression of Michigan fans, and I'll be generous here, is that they're generally speaking a fairly decent, classy lot. You know,
I agree
really
with that.
Problem
yeah.
with them.
Yeah.
And
maybe
you know,
they're just a bit more sophisticated.
I feel the same way about Penn State fans too. At least Mike.
Yeah, no, my most shocking
I've heard nothing but good about Penn State fans. When we won there,
was with Brother Tommy,
the
LSU fans.
But my most shocking
was the brother with Brother Tommy, the LSU fans. Unbelievably gracious, fun loving, supportive. Yeah, classy. I mean, they were just
the fucking best band in the country.
I have no experience with that, so that's good to hear.
Totally classy. And I'm just going by the boards, but after the Adrian Claiborne block at Penn State when we ended up winning the game, after that game, all the boards, the guys that traveled there said, oh, my God, kind of what Hawkeye Mike said. They're like, oh, my God, these fans are so cool, man. They're cool. They're dignified. They accept losses, with a grain of salt. You know, it's just like totally cool. But yeah, anyone ever asked me, I've never experienced Penn State. They weren't in the Big Ten when I was there. But anyone asked me best fan base in the country, I won't even say Iowa. I'll say LSU. They were so cool.
Yeah, they were.
Those motherfuckers know how to tailgate. Remember that, Bob? Hank?
Oh,
remember that?
First of all, think about this. Think about 27 different versions of Cajun sausage and red beans and rice and booze. I mean, they have like 27 different cocktails depending on which, you know, it's like, oh, wait, the kickoff's at 1:13 p.m., so that means we got to do the purple and gold, you know, whatever. I mean, and, oh, we got to give these Iowa guys a couple shots. No, don't give him 12. He should only have 11. I mean, they're literally that generous, that gracious. They have these huge tailgate parties and invite everybody in. It's unbelievable.
We had this little grill with steaks and stuff. I felt like a poodle in a den of Newfoundlands or Doberman Pinschers stuff. I mean, these guys know how to do it. They've got TVs out there. They don't have a grill out there. They have grills, plural. They do one over here, one over there. Oh, man, do they play it right.
They love their college football down in that part.
They do.
You know,
here's a good one. Here's a good one. Bigfoot in the chat room. Bigfoot says he worked with a University of Michigan alum whose husband went to Ohio State. Man.
Wow.
I mean, can you imagine on Christmas putting a gift under the tree from Santa, you know, if you're the husband with an Ohio State jersey and the wife, I mean, that I would love to have been a fly on that wall.
Just give them a Michigan State jersey.
Hey, listen, I have to ask you guys a question before we end things, because to me, this was the most striking thing about what happened Saturday. I look forward to more of it next Saturday. And that was just the sheer, you know, seeing the full stadiums and the crowds going crazy, the whole pageantry of college football, which we hadn't seen for 2 years. I mean, it was so great. It was like a breath of fresh air, good for the country. And it was basically, to me, like everybody there telling all those people back, you know, where in the blue state, let's say the Democrats, right?
Right.
Fuck you. We want to move on with our lives.
Yep.
It was great.
Oh, yeah. I'm like Henry Fonda. I think he was famous for saying, I'll cry at a rare steak. I'll cry pretty easily. And I'll tell you what, Hawkeye Mike, that sums it all, what you just said, because my boys go to University of Florida, so I saw the same thing at Ben Hill Griffith Stadium. I think I shed a tear, literally, because I'm like, oh, my God, this is so cool. And I will tell you guys something else real quick. real quick. Say what you want about Wisconsin. But that jump around thing, they showed the whole thing.
I love it.
The coolest thing in football.
The first time I watched that on Big, it was on Big Ten Network when it was, you know, Wisconsin at, or Minnesota at Wisconsin, and it wasn't the year Minnesota was really good a couple years ago. It was like 2 years before that, but Minnesota was still good. But they showed the jump around, and they showed like on Big Ten Network, like which Big Ten Network people were jump around the whole time, and like Jerry DiNardo, of course, didn't. But they showed, they panned out of the field. Half of Minnesota's team was doing it. I mean, that's how cool. I love the wave.
The
wave is awesome.
The
way
that was doing it, the dopamine levels at that place, I mean, Homeland Security put out a bulletin saying we've got some massive dopamine levels, unruly ones, in Madison, Wisconsin. I love the wave
and what it stands for, and I think it's awesome. And I initially thought it was going to be really stupid. And I think waving to those kids in the hospital, that is awesome, no doubt about it. But in terms of sheer energy, the jump around, at least in the Big Ten, the jump around is number one. Yeah, nothing is.
My wife said that she, Mrs. Brother Tommy, said, "My God, are the stands going to collapse?" And I'm like, "God, you would think so. 85,000 people all just jumping up and down. I have never been so riveted."
When you haven't done it in over a year, you know. Mike, I don't remember if you listened when Justin Britt's parents were on. Were you on that show?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. I mean, and you remember what Sam said, the father. You know, even last year, even though it wasn't, you know, the same as, you know, with cardboard cutouts and stuff, he said, as a parent, you still feel it. You know what I mean? So I imagine parents were already feeling it all last year, even though. But, I mean, can you imagine, you know.
On him. He didn't get burned at all, did he? He had a good game.
Oh, no, he did not get burned at all. I think that's why I say
he's a starter, right? And he played most of the game.
Yeah, no, but that's why I think that's why I say
he's going to be a star.
That's why I think the offensive line. That's the other thing about our offensive line. You almost don't even know who's out on the field at any given time, other than Linderbaum. But that's how good a job they're all doing.
Yeah.
That's why I think that's going to be crucial to the, you know, the. But
did
yeah,
you guys
oh, Andy Hawk pointed.
Did you guys swallow your heart when Linderbaum was in the end zone? When Lindenbaum was in the end zone and he started grabbing his leg, did you guys swallow your heart like I did?
I didn't see that, thank
that
God.
That was a very difficult moment. I thought, oh, my God.
Very. Very difficult. I mean,
I want to welcome Sue to the phone. Sue's calling in. Hope you're doing okay, Sue. I know you've, like Vito said, Sue needs prayer, but thanks for being here. You're just catching the tail end of our all our good sports talk, so. Anyway,
one final comment I'd like to make to you guys, and that's, you know, we got game day coming in, which will be nice. I'll be up there. It'll be fun to watch. You know, it's great for the state of Iowa, for the Iowa-Iowa State game, to have them there just like it was 2 years ago. And so look forward to that. I was there 2 years ago when they first came. And we were tailgating. I didn't go. They were over other end of work from where I was at. I didn't go over there because I heard there's a giant crowd. You can't get near them. And because someone was making mean Bloody Marys where I was at. So I was happy to stay where I was. No need to stray from that. Exactly. I didn't know. Maybe you put it in the text. Am I still on?
Yeah, you're on.
Oh, maybe you put in the text, Hawkeye Mike. You're going to the game?
No, I went 2 years ago.
Here's what's kind of disappointing. It is the 20th anniversary of 9/11, and at one point there was talk that with the Air Force at Navy game that game day would be there. So that's kind of disappointing to me. I think on the 20th anniversary of 9/11, although. As somebody else pointed out, you know, Navy and Air Force weren't in the initial thing. That was really first responders and stuff. But still, I just think that's kind of, you know, you'd think on the anniversary of 9/11. On the other hand, you know, it's an intrastate rivalry where both teams are ranked, you know, for the first time I think it's the first time since we've renewed the rivalry.
Both are top 10.
Both teams are in the top, but now both teams are top 10. So, you know, that's pretty huge, and it is it's not as big as a conference game, no matter what anybody says. We know how much more important conference games are, but there is something to be said for an intrastate rivalry, with having two teams in the top 10 playing each other, that's pretty cool. I mean, that's for Hawkeye fans and Cyclone fans as well. That's big. I mean, that's a.
If we have to lose week one or week two, I definitely go with week two.
Here's a potential bigger deal for Iowa for Circle October 9th. If Iowa can get the win here against Iowa State, October 9th, Penn State is coming to Iowa City. If Penn State, and I think there's a good chance they'll be undefeated, and Iowa's undefeated, I think there's a good chance of game day in Iowa City.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. Wanstead, I don't know if I already said this. I told someone else. I was talking to someone before the show. Wanstead said this Saturday, unless we go to the Big Ten championship game, he says this Saturday is going to be our biggest test. He says this is going to be the toughest team Iowa plays for the rest of the year unless they go to the Big Ten championship game. Obviously, he's referring to Ohio State.
I think that might be right, but I'll tell you
it's hard to say how good Penn State is.
It's a non-conference game.
Yeah. It's hard to say how good Penn State is or even Wisconsin. I mean, I think Wisconsin had five opportunities inside the red zone. And I think they had two of them in the last 5 minutes, and they just absolutely
whizzed it down. They had two times, first and goal on the 2-yard line or better, and they fucked them both up. That team is much better than the score indicated. They should have won by 2 touchdowns. Remember that time we beat them when they fumbled the ball on the 1-yard line? For some reason, they came to do that. I don't know why, because Chris, I think, is a fantastic coach. But that's going to be a thing, and I think we play them in Madison, if I'm not mistaken. And
Madison, October
30th.
October
30th.
Yeah, so
it'll be October 30th.
It'll only be 8 below for that game. So,
global warming, man.
Did either of you watch the Michigan State Northwestern? Because I don't know what happened to Northwestern.
Michigan State is for real. Michigan State looked good.
Yeah,
they're for real.
I think I agree with Tom.
They are for real. In fact, they might give Ohio State a run. I'm not crazy about Penn State. Don't like their offense. I think Michigan State. I disagree with what you said earlier, Hank. It was a bounce game for Illinois. It was a bounce game. It happens all the time. They were only 7-point favorites. You should have known right then. Okay, UTSA is a damn good football team.
Yeah, but you know what? You just don't throw that kind of momentum away.
Here's the sleeper team. They will bounce back. You watch. Rutgers. Look out for Rutgers.
I'm telling you, they
showed some promise at the end of the year. Keanu's got a team.
They had a great recruiting class
from what
next
I've heard.
Year.
Yep. Well, no, I mean,
okay, guys,
they brought stuff in last year.
Okay, guys,
but
we're under a minute.
Michigan State.
I got to sign.
Michigan State are going to be the underdogs that could win the West.
Okay, final. Mike, your prediction Saturday. Just a straight up. No score, nothing. Just who wins Saturday.
I think the Hawks get it done.
Tommy.
I'm going to give score. Hawks 24, Iowa State 16.
Okay, I'm going to go with Mike. I'm going to say Hawks get it done. Let's hope it's done before 11 p.m. and I'm not 6 shots to the wind, and we'll go from there. Hey, I want to thank everybody. Indy Hawk, Duck Northwest, Bigfoot, Banjo, Sue, Big Sister, Mike and Tommy, of course, and my buddy Steve earlier for being here. Guys, we're under the gun. We've got to cut it short. Thanks for being here, everyone. Go Hawkeyes this Saturday. We'll be back next week.
Good talking
thank
to you,
all.
Hawkeye, Mike and Hank. Good talking
good
to you.
Thanks,
Hank. Go Hawks.
Go Hawks.